Welcome to On Script's Biblical World, a podcast exploring the history, archaeology, geography, and cultures of the Bible. Visit us at onscript.study/biblicalworld.
Hey everyone, this is Matt Lynch coming to you from Regent College in Vancouver, although currently in Jerusalem, Israel with my family here, and you're going to be listening now to part four of our journey through the Epic of Gilgamesh. We hope you enjoy this series. If you haven't listened to the other episodes, you can go back and listen to the first three. And thanks so much to Jason Stark for producing this episode and to all of you who support OnScript and Biblical World on a regular basis. We appreciate that. Hope you enjoy the episode.
Welcome back, Biblical World listeners. This is Chris McKinney. I am hosting today the Gilgamesh Epic series with Amy. Amy, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. How about yourself?
Doing pretty good. So it's exciting to get back into this topic that I've had a lot of fun time recording so far. Today we're looking actually at Tablet 3 of the Epic of Gilgamesh, which should be a very interesting study as we continue to move forward. I think we've talked about this, that some tablets actually may take a couple of episodes. We're pretty confident that Tablet 3 probably can be covered fairly quickly in one episode. And so you've taught Gilgamesh before in the classroom. What would you characterize Tablet 3? How would you characterize that?
I would characterize this as a really interesting and to some people maybe boring a window into the Mesopotamian cult. So if you aren't familiar with some of the language and the rituals that they use, then it'll be probably pretty foreign. But once you kind of like imagine what's happening and kind of get into some of the characters and what's going on, it has a couple of different layers that I think are pretty interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I do normally skip it with undergrads.
Well, you guys aren't undergrad. Well, if you're undergrads and you've taken a class with Amy, you get to hear what you didn't hear. And if you are interested to continue in Gilgamesh, we're going to expand on what we've covered thus far. And so I would just give us a quick refresher. We have covered Tablet 1 and Tablet 2 over the course of three episodes. And in those episodes, we try to place Gilgamesh in its wider setting in the ancient Near East. And our goal throughout this study is going to be to focus on the Epic of Gilgamesh and use it as a lens by which we can see the biblical world. And so anytime there is a direct connection between the Epic of Gilgamesh and what we see in the biblical text or a biblical idea, we're trying to draw direct attention to it. So we've seen, or we've brought up, we haven't got there yet in the story, but the most obvious one, of course, is the flood. The Epic of Gilgamesh brings in the Mesopotamian flood story and its flood hero. And when we get there, we'll go into much more depth to see its connections with Genesis 6 and 9. But as we've looked at this, I hope it's clear that the connections between what we see in the Epic of Gilgamesh and the Epic of the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, especially in Genesis, but not limited to that, it's of the same cultural milieu, matrix, context, and they often come up with the same ideas, the same conclusions. And even, I would say, today, when we're dealing with something that is directly connected with Mesopotamian religion and into the cult and into these things that, again, if we're in the 21st century, we're saying, like, I wouldn't do religion that way. Well, the Bible does stuff like that as well. Now, that's not to say that there's not a particularly Mesopotamian flair to these. And in fact, there's multiple types of flares depending on which edition that you're reading of the Epic of Gilgamesh. And of course, it was written and recorded and adapted over a long period of time. And so we're not going to necessarily be concerned with always trying to bring those aspects out. Our goal, once again, is to try to see this as a story, how it impacted people in its own context, and how these things have been essentially we can see the influence directly and indirectly on the biblical story. And so far in the story, we've seen Gilgamesh at his palace in Uruk. We've seen the challenge of having an authoritarian ruler who has no constraints. He sleeps with whoever he wants before they're married. He kills whoever he wants. He does essentially whatever he wants. And yet he's handsome. He's heroic. He has these good qualities. And then the gods have created Enkidu as his twin, as his counterpart. Enkidu has gone through a process of becoming human. We talked about that over an entire episode, which is a very interesting part of this myth. They've prepared their weapons after a conflict between the two and the two met. A new idea is, well, now that we're best buds, Enkidu and Gilgamesh, let's go kill Humbaba, this great demon, monster, fire breather, kind of a predecessor to Grendel from Beowulf. Let's go kill him in the cedars of Lebanon. So they've made their weapons. These heroes are about to go to war, and they still have some preparations to do, because it's not enough to prepare by having your weapons. You have to have the permission of the gods and their blessing. And that's really what Tablet 3 is about. It's talking to Shamash and talking to Ninsun, these gods of Mesopotamia, to bless their journey. And this is, so in some ways, you could say that this is one of the most essential parts of how the story works, because it's showing the unseen realm of Mesopotamia, how the gods actually impact the story. And so we'll read it in just a second, but I'm going to give Amy a chance to speak into what we would need to know and have in our mind as we read through this story.
And I'll just add that when we ended last time in Tablet 2, there was some tension within the community about whether this was a good idea. And it ended with the senior advisors telling Gilgamesh that he's young and he's borne along by emotion, and he doesn't understand what he's talking about when it comes to this journey. And in the end, he just says to Enkidu, like, how frightened am I? But in fear will I change my mind. And so he recognizes that maybe this isn't a good idea, but he's sticking with it anyway, because it's on his mind. So his character hasn't done any of the development that we would hope at this point, but at least he's being open about that. So I guess there's maybe hope for him as a character. So that's kind of what we're coming in with as well, in terms of where they're at in their thoughts.
When you said that, it really called to mind a common, like, mythic motif or epic motif. One of my favorite lines in Game of Thrones, which, to those who've actually read the books, is A Song of Ice and Fire, is there's three brothers of House Baratheon, and they each have a chance to be king. So the books start with Robert Baratheon as king, and he's won the independence and made the Baratheons the ruling house over the Targaryens. When he dies, and I won't give any spoilers for those of you who haven't seen the show or read the books, his brother, he tries to become king, but he's not really well liked, but he's very hard and fast and true. And then that's the middle brother's name is Stannis. And then the second brother is, he looks like his older brother. He's handsome and everybody loves him, but he has really no backbone. And the image that is talked about in the books, and I don't know if it made it into the show, is that you had Renly, the youngest, who was brass and really nice to look at, but ultimately soft. And then you had Stannis, who was brittle as iron, because he had no ability to be able to shift when the struggles came. And so his whole perspective was brittle and he would shatter. And it was Robert Baratheon who was the true steel. And so I just love the way that line kind of retrojected back into the story of, like, how you could actually use a symbol of metal to think about these characters in this way. And I think if we think of this story of Gilgamesh, he's going to go through a similar process of tempering tempering in his character to become that true steel of what he needs to be that final character that we actually read about at the beginning when he's writing this tablet about it. So this is the beginning of that, quest. And of course, they've just made these medals and now he's pretty foolish. But there's also this sense of being foolhardy may actually be a good thing, like to be bold. It's a great tense moment in this part of the story. And so maybe there's you know, some appearance between House Baratheon in the fictional world of George R.R. Martin and Gilgamesh here. Let's read it though before I give another extended metaphor about fantasy. So, and I'm going to start at the beginning of Tablet 3. And this is entitled Preparations for the Expedition to the Forest of Cedar. The elders of Uruk, the sheepfold, spoke to Gilgamesh. To Uruk's quay, come back in safety. Do not rely, O Gilgamesh, on your strength alone. Look long and hard. Land a blow you can count on. Who goes in front saves his companion. Who knows the road protects his friend. Let Enkidu go before you. He knows the journey to the forest of cedar. He is tested in battle and tried in combat. He shall guard his friend and keep safe his companion. Enkidu shall bring him safe home to his wives. To Enkidu. In our assembly, we place the king in your care. You bring him back and replace him in ours. Gilgamesh opened his mouth to speak, saying to Enkidu, come, my friend. Let us go to the palace sublime, into the presence of the great queen Ninsun. Ninsun is clever and wise, well-versed in everything. She will set our feet in steps of good counsel. Taking each other hand in hand, Gilgamesh and Enkidu went to the palace sublime, into the presence of the great queen Ninsun. Gilgamesh rose and entered before her. Said Gilgamesh to her, to Ninsun, I shall tread, O Ninsun, bold as I am, the distant path to the home of Humbaba. I shall face a battle I know not. I shall ride a road I know not. I beseech you, give me your blessing for my journey. Let me see your face again in safety and return glad at heart through Uruk's gate. On my return, I will celebrate New Year's twice over. I will celebrate the festival twice in the year. Let the festival take place. The merriment begin. Let the drums resound in your presence. Wild cow Ninsun listened long and with sadness to the words of Gilgamesh, her son, and Enkidu. Into the bathhouse she went seven times. She bathed herself in water of tamarisk and soapwort. She donned a fine dress to adorn her body. She chose a jewel to adorn her breast. Having put on her cap, she donned her tiara. We have a break here. It says, the harlots, the ground. She climbed the staircase and went up on the roof. On the roof, she set up a censer to Shamash. Scattering incense, she lifted her arms in appeal to the sun god. Why did you afflict my son Gilgamesh with so restless a spirit? For now you have touched him, and he will tread the distant path to the home of Humbaba. He will face a battle he knows not. He will ride a road he knows not. During the days of his journey there and back, until he reaches the forest of cedar, until he slays ferocious Humbaba and annihilates from the land the evil thing you abhor. Each day when you travel the circuit of the earth, may Aya the bride unfearing remind you, entrust him to the care of the watches of the night at eventide break. You opened, O Shamash, the gates for the herd to go out, for you came forth for the land. The uplands took shape. The heavens grew bright. The beasts of the wild break. Your ruddy glow. At the coming forth of your light is gathered the crowd. The divine Anunnaki await your brilliance. May Aya the bride unfearing remind you. Entrust him to the care of the watches of the night. Also, break. While Gilgamesh travels to the forest of cedar, let the days be long, let the nights be short, Let his loins be girt. Let his stride be sure. Let him pitch at nightfall a camp for the night. Let nighttime break. May Aya the bride unfearing remind you. The day Gilgamesh and Enkidu encounter Humbaba. O Shamash, rouse against Humbaba the mighty gale winds, south wind, north wind, east wind, and west wind. Blast, counterblast, typhoon, hurricane, and tempest, devil wind, frost wind, gale, and tornado. Let rise 13 winds and Humbaba's face darken. Let the weapons of Gilgamesh then reach Humbaba, after your very own fires are kindled. At that time, O Shamash, turn your face to the supplicant. Your fleet-footed mules shall bear you onwards. A restful seat, a bed for the night, shall be what awaits you. The gods, your brothers, shall bring food to delight you. Aya the bride shall wipe your face dry with the fringe of her garment. Again, wild cow Ninsun made her request before Shamash. O Shamash, will not Gilgamesh, blank, the gods, will he not share the heavens with you? Will he not share with the moon a scepter and crown? Will he not grow wise with Ea of the ocean below? Will he not rule with Ernina, the black-headed people? Will he not dwell with Ningenshizda in the land of no return? Let me make him, O Shamash, blank, lest he, blank, lest he, blank, probably die, in the forest of cedar. After Wild Cow Ninsun had charged Shamash thus, Wild Cow Ninsun was clever and wise, well-versed in everything, the mother of Gilgamesh. She smothered the censer and came down from the roof. She summoned Enkidu and declared her will. O mighty Enkidu, you are not sprung from my womb, but henceforth your brood will belong with the votaries of Gilgamesh. The priestesses, the hierodules, and the women of the temple shall put the symbols on Enkidu's neck. The priestesses took in the foundling, and the divine daughters brought up the foster child. Enkidu, whom I love, I take for my son. Enkidu and brother Gilgamesh shall favor him. Also, while you travel together to the forest of cedar, let the days be long, let the nights be short, let your loins be girt, let your stride be sure. At nightfall, pinch a camp for the night, let protect. Here's a longer break, but we assume that it has to do with a type of ritual to give them aid in their journey. And then it resumes after a few lines, but it's also broken here. Gilgamesh, his to the cedar, to the gate of cedar, Enkidu in the chapel break, and Gilgamesh in the chapel of break, juniper, incense break, members of the blank were present. By the command of Shamash, you will attain your desire in the gate of Marduk, on the breast of the water break, the back break, and the gate of cedar knot break, Gilgamesh break, and Enkidu break. Lots of breaks here. At 20 leagues, you should break bread. Then there's a really long break, and we finally have more instructions about running the city of Uruk. This is from Gilgamesh to essentially the mayor of the city. During the days of our journey there and back, until we reach the forest of cedar, until we slay ferocious Humbaba and annihilate him from the land of the evil thing Shamash abhors, may you acquire no break. The officers must not assemble young men in the street, judge the lawsuit of the weak, seek out blank, while we attain our desires like babies in arms and plant our weapons in Humbaba's gate. The officers stood there wishing him well. The young men of Uruk ran behind in a mob, and the officers kissed his feet. To Uruk's quay, come back in safety. Do not rely, O Gilgamesh, on your strength alone. Look long and hard. Land a blow you can count on. Who goes in front will save his comrade. Who knows the road shall guard his friend. Let Enkidu go before you. He knows the journey to the forest of cedar. He is tested in battle and tried in combat. through the mountain passes he often has journeyed. He shall guard his friend and keep his companion. Enkidu shall bring him safe home to his wives. To Enkidu, in our assembly, we place the king in your care. You bring him back and replace him in ours. Enkidu opened his mouth to speak, saying to Gilgamesh, my friend, turn back. Do not pursue this journey. There's about 10 lines missing at this point, but the tablet ends here. Enkidu opened his mouth, saying to Gilgamesh, where you've set your mind, begin the journey. Let your heart have no fear. Keep your eyes on me. And the forest, I knew his lair, and the ways too that Humbaba wonders. Speak to the crowd and send them home. They should not go with me, blank, to you. The crowd with your happy heart, blank, they heard what he had said. The young men made a fervent prayer. Go, Gilgamesh. Let, blank, may your God go before you. May Shamash let you attain your goal. Gilgamesh and Enkidu went forth. Tablet 3 of Gilgamesh. And I just want to say before we move on that we are reading, as we have been, from the Penguin Classics series, translated by Andrew George, which is an excellent translation. And so if you're trying to follow along in this translation, that's the one we're using.
Well, thank you, Chris.
Yeah, it's very fragmented, to say the least. So one of the things that I noticed about this read-through is actually, I think, just kind of a fun translation thing. I noticed a couple of times the choices made to talk about Enkidu and Gilgamesh's journey as there and back again, which obviously has a certain nice echo in English ears for those people who have lived after The Hobbit. And actually, I think that there's some interesting, just again, epic story elements. You know, we think of Enkidu as kind of like the guide for Gilgamesh. He's treaded on these paths before, at least for my mind, immediately goes to Aragorn being the person who is a ranger who guides Frodo on his quest. And there's going to be, even in that sense, where Enkidu and Gilgamesh have become very close, but this common love for one another, that they're willing to give their lives for each other, which is something you see, I think, a common theme that you find in these heroic stories. So that's just more of a literary observation. But I would also comment more on the figures involved. I mean, we encounter, of course, within Uruk, this city that has multiple gods, Ishtar being the chief of those gods for this area. But she's not talked about here. It's going to be Shamash, this personal deity, you might say, to some extent, or not personal in the sense of maybe Yahweh going with Abraham as he goes to Canaan, but personal in the sense that he is taking a particular care for Gilgamesh and now Enkidu. And at the request of Ninsun, we have clear requests to help them on their quest. And so maybe the first thing to do is to think about, who are these people? Who are Shamash? What is Aya, his consort? And what might they mean? And so I would just say, from my view, I think some really nice points of contact for Shamash. One is within the biblical text itself. It's the same word, the cognate for the Hebrew word for sun. And, you know, one of the most famous places in Israel is Beit Shemesh. That literally means the house of the sun. Now, by the time you get to Hebrew, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're saying the house of the worship of Shamash. They may just say that it's particularly hot there, which, by the way, it is in the summer. It's almost always just miserable. But you can see a similarity on the level of language. And there's other things as well we could point out with the Psalms, which maybe we'll talk about in a minute. But I also want to make an ancient Near Eastern connection, a Mesopotamian connection, with one of the most well-known objects in the ancient world, and that is the law code of Hammurabi or Amurapi, as he's, you know, it just depends on who you ask how you pronounce his name. And at the top of that law code, we have a enthroned god wearing a 8-horned tiara, seated upon a throne over the waters of the heavens, with several people, including most likely a king, perhaps Hammurabi himself, appearing before him. And this is Shamash. Shamash, in the Mesopotamian thought, was believed to be the lawgiver. He is the one who both gives laws, but he's also the one whose job it is to carry out justice. And so he's a very important god. He's not the highest of gods in the Mesopotamian pantheon, but he's an extremely important one for the way that they think about the world. And I would even say, if that is true, and every indication is that it is, it's very interesting that he is the choice for the personal god for Enkidu and Gilgamesh on this quest, because this goes back to what the whole point of the story is, and so, at least in one sense. And that is the refining, the tempering, you might even call making legal the actions of Gilgamesh as a king. I mean, part of the story is actually Enkidu is sort of the hero, Gilgamesh is sort of the hero, but Gilgamesh is also, if we're to point to one villain in the story, it's probably Gilgamesh. And so it's just interesting to think about Shamash in that way. And I'll have a couple other things to say as we think about the appeal to Shamash with Ninsun and how that connects with some other Mesopotamian stories.
And one of the things that stood out to me in reading this time through is that you have a hierarchy of gods here that is present. So it's not enough that, you know, Gilgamesh, who's already 2/3 god, goes to his mother, who's fully divine. But as soon as she agrees to have this blessing, her first thing to do is to then kind of ritually purify herself and present herself to Shamash. So she's kind of going up the hierarchy to secure this passage for them. And so there's like an acknowledgement there of this. And then even within that, Ninsun ropes in Aya, who is apparently not present, right? So the idea is that she's somewhere doing other business, but still she gets roped in as part of the supplication to Shamash, basically saying like, may your wife remind you of these things. So it's very human, but it's got this, you know, the hierarchy of the gods is certainly there as well.
Yeah, I felt like there were kind of like echoes of Elijah's trash talk in 1 Kings 18, where he's talking to the prophets of Baal, like, what is your God doing? Does he need a reminder? Is he on a vacation? Now he does. They don't go into and say Asherah is his consort, but I thought the same thing. It's like, Shamash, you might need a reminder on occasion. And I think that's a great point that you bring out, that in these thoughts, one of the main concepts is, yeah, the gods have their own agendas, but they're a lot like us. They're a lot like us with desires, whether they be appetites, sexual, food, drink. And so related to even that, one of the things I noticed as well is when Ninsun goes to Shamash, she doesn't go into a temple. Mm-hmm. She doesn't go out in nature. She actually goes to a roof, which of course is open to the sky. And she pulls out a censer, which we can assume would have had incense on it. And this incense goes up to the gods. I think this is an incredibly important thing for people who are not pagan, which is most of us that live in the 21st century, although it's on the rise, which at least for Chesterton and C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, they say is a good thing. So that's good. But for us to think about how you worship different types of divinities actually is divided. So if you're worshiping a sky god, you are going to burn, whether it's a burnt offering sacrifice or incense, that they smell and consume and becomes a pleasing aroma. If you're going to worship a chthonic deity or a thonic deity, a deity of the ground or of the underworld, you actually pour out a drink offering, or it could be a blood offering, so that they consume that. And so they don't go before Shamash and offer a sacrifice. They pour out a drink offering, because he's in the sky. So you see this divided up. And within the biblical account, I think it's important to see that those attributes of cult are brought together, so that there is both the worship of Yahweh as a sky god, as an earth god, and in some sense, even, I don't know if I want to call Yahweh an underworld deity, but you have the sense that there's drink offerings that are poured out, there's sacrifices that are made, and there's incense continually being offered. And so you have this combined, and it even goes back to the Ten Commandments, where you have the worship of, not worshiping of a god of the sky or of the earth or beneath the earth. And so you don't have this audience in front of you, but if you pull up an image of Shamash, he is literally seated on the waters of the Rakia, you know, of the firmament, and he's receiving this. And so I think that's just a helpful way of, when we read the Bible, we don't have that conception that the ancient Near Eastern people did about the division of these three different parts of the world that are being ruled over by different deities. The Israelites did, but they proclaimed that Yahweh actually rules over them all. So it's like you have to like go back to paganism to understand, and then you're like, oh, maybe that's not the true thing, at least from the biblical perception, and you put it back together again, whereas we are seeing the sausage after it's been made, and we don't get to see the ingredients of how all those things work. And so for me, I think that's an incredible way of thinking about these types of stories. Anyway, I've talked long enough. I'll let Amy, if you have something to add to that.
Well, just to piggyback off of that, that's kind of the process of understanding monotheism, right? And how it comes together, because there's so much going on in both systems, right? In polytheism and monotheism. And in a lot of ways, monotheism kind of like condenses a lot of it, which is, I think, is what you're talking about, where instead of having, you know, these gods of various tiers, you have one god in charge of all of it. And so with that, there comes, like you said, the sausage squeeze of putting it all in one casing. And so, but as people on this side of the timeline, we don't always recognize that for what it is. And so it's, I think, a testament to this like long historical process of monotheism. And also kind of shows why that took so long to take hold, because there's a lot of complexity behind it. And to just have one figure do everything, you could see why that would be a stretch to a lot of people, especially when you have these very anthropomorphic deities who are not wholly other, right? Like they're just, as you mentioned, they have the same needs, desires, as we see in this passage and a bunch of others from Mesopotamia. They're also beholden to things like purity rituals. They're beholden to, like, here we have Nunsung, who's a goddess, having to go through a ritual to talk to another deity. It's not like she just goes and sees him, right? So you have like a lot of complexity going into not only this story, but kind of part of that transition into monotheism is like, how do we meet all of these needs that polytheism meets and do it in one god?
Yeah, such an interesting part of this conversation. And I would say the more you dig into this whole question of how we get from polytheism to monotheism, the more I wonder, is this kind of a modern construct to some extent? And I'm more of the view that, what I mean by this is to say, when we say the word monotheism, we have a very particular thing.
Right.
God the Father, maybe the Trinity, maybe it's the Judeo-Christian God, and then all the other stuff is just doesn't exist.
Right.
And so what I would say to those people have that view. I think that whether we're talking about the Hebrew Bible, the Apocrypha, Pseudepigrapha, or the New Testament, I think the view is actually not fitting in with what the biblical text argues. I would say that you have what could be called sort of polytheistic, even within the biblical context, is like back to the story of Elijah and the prophets of Baal. Elijah never says to the prophets of Baal, maybe he just doesn't exist. He says maybe he's using the toilet. But there's this concept of Yahweh as preeminent. And so I think a word that is constantly used is this concept of monolarity, mm-hmm. of worship. And so, and I don't want to go into this because it's a huge topic, but just to make a comment even on points of history where you had similar movements as to what happens within Judaism and it gets carried over into Christianity. And of course, the biggest one is Akhenaten. You know, Akhenaten in Egypt, a move towards a reduction of the powers of these other gods and an elevation of the Aten as the chief god. And I think at different times in even Greco-Roman history, you could make the case that that's what's being happening with Zeus or Jupiter. And so I think just to touch on this really quickly and say that it makes the story, I'm talking about to those who consider it to be true in the sense of a spiritual reality, and for those who consider it to be just myth, I'd say one of the mythic qualities for both of those groups is if we see this element of the unseen realm, these characters as we have them in Gilgamesh, and as we actually see them in the Bible, some places, Job, you know, it says, "And the sons of God sang for joy," that it's incredibly interesting. It makes the story work much better. And it also, when we get to these triumphs, like, okay, if Gilgamesh and Enkidu, spoiler alert, they're going to beat Humbaba. But if Humbaba is a figment of their imagination, that's not interesting. That's not cool. If Jesus's death and resurrection didn't actually defeat a real divinity who has considerable power, it loses some of its just, you know, some of its narrative epic weight. And so I think that something like the Epic of Gilgamesh helps us see these epic stories for what they are, and helps us reconsider a lot of the things that we may have come to conclusions on without considering the world in which they were written. And I have one other thing that I'd like to say about this tablet, or a couple other things, specifically about the pantheon, but I want to pass it back to you to see if you have some other things to say about this.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that happens with the you know, kind of the function of the humanness of some of these characters is to do exactly what you said, and that's to bring them to life, to help you relate, to help you insert yourself into the story and really see what's happening. Like, there's a real stake here, right? It's not just the gods are not abstract concepts, right? Like the universe or something, or the cosmos or something, like how people might talk about powers that be today. They're very involved in your life. They know everything about what it is to be human. Of course, they have a layer of privilege that the rest of us don't, because they're divine, but they still have to live in relationship. They still have all these earthly things to contend with. And that's just part of the longevity of these traditions and why they lasted thousands and thousands of years, is that there's a relatability there that you just don't see if you think of just, oh, Shamash is just the sun god, right? Like, he's the way people kind of understood science, right? Like, this isn't like a pre-science, like this isn't people trying to do science, right? And so it's like mythology is a whole other thing. And really, in the personification of these figures, brings that to life for people and makes them committed in a way that maybe more people struggle with today. I'm not sure. I think when we start thinking about gods as abstract, then it kind of challenges our ability to connect. But they didn't really seem to have that problem. But I think this particular tablet, I like that they slow down and show us this, right? And then it's kind of a break actually from hearing about Gilgamesh and Enkidu all the time, because you kind of see the slow grinding of the divine process in the support of these characters.
Yeah, I think that's such a good point. And you made me think of C.S. Lewis has a book, I cannot remember the name right now, but I read it earlier this year, in which he talks about this concept, even in terms of like the relationship of the Godhead as being like a father-son relationship. And he's saying, in some sense, it's deficient because it doesn't encompass all of what there is. And I think an analogy could be made here in saying these types of thoughts are not the whole thing, but actually the ones that we've come up with in the modern world, which is just completely rational and an answer for everything, they're not any better, and they don't answer some of these deeper questions. And so if I were to speak for C.S. Lewis, and I won't necessarily do that completely, I would think he would say that some of these, we can use these types of symbols that we have in mythology, and especially when we have it in the biblical text, to be a bridge for help us understand these in ways that are well beyond just looking up at the stars and seeing, as Pumbaa said, balls of glass burning millions of miles away from Lion King, if you didn't catch that reference. Another thing that I found to be two things I just wanted to bring out, and that is this whole scene really reminds me of Hannah, in the sense of Hannah goes to the tabernacle. She has a request, and it's about protection. It's about childbearing. It's also going to be later about protection of her son, who's going to be Samuel. And then also we skip ahead in the story, we see that when Samuel is born and he's in the tabernacle, the light of the menorah has not gone out. And so that there's this kind of like personal legend, story, epic that develops around Samuel. And he has this personal God who's caring for him, watching his steps and leading him down the right paths. And once again, we see in terms of the ritual, we have paying careful attention to what Hannah is doing in that story in 1 Samuel, where she's coming before a tabernacle. She doesn't bring a censer or anything. In fact, we're told before that there's actually problems with the things that are happening there. And so she comes at it humbly, without pretense, and yet she has a similar request, not unlike Ninsun, to protect her son. And so I think there's an interesting analogy that can be made between those two stories. There's a lot of similarity. The other thing, I've been talking to people, scholars, about this series, and one of the things that has come up is really the development. Like, as much as we know about Gilgamesh, it's also like, well, if we just had an entire version of what it looked like in 1800 BC, and then in a version of that, what it looked like in the seventh century, it would tell us so much more. We only have these glimpses. But in terms of the development of the story, I was really struck, and this is line of tablet 3, 100 through about 105, by something that seems almost contradictory to the message of Gilgamesh. So far we've been saying that Gilgamesh is about death, right? Gilgamesh is about actually dealing with, it's multi-layered, but it's him realizing that he is king. He can't act the way he's acting with absolute power. He has to love his people, serve his people, be their shepherd. And he has to realize he's not going to live forever, that death awaits him. And the way he learns that is through, spoiler alert, Enkidu, and Enkidu not surviving it. And it's just this mourning that he has to deal with. But the natural implication from this is that he's going to join either, I wouldn't say non-existence in the ancient world, because I don't think there's a whole lot of clear evidence that people just cease to exist upon death. Of course, in the Bible and Egypt and other places, you have an underworld where shades dwell. In the Bible, it's Sheol. In Egypt, it's more sophisticated. But if you'll notice in this section, that doesn't seem to be the destiny of Gilgamesh. Ninsun says around line 100, O Shamash, will not Gilgamesh, and it's broken, the gods, will he not share the heavens with you? Will he not share with the moon a scepter and crown? So it's very interesting when we think about this story as almost like a spoiler for, is this the destiny of Gilgamesh to join the gods? If it is, what's he worried about? Does he know that information? Is Ninsun keeping that back from him? Is this particular piece an earlier or later development in all of this idea of a glorification of Gilgamesh is not in the final version? I think that that's an interesting thing to think about because, you know, one of the things that I've been thinking about lately is even the concept of how we have this idea of becoming a god in Greek mythology. Of course, the most famous deification is Hercules, where he's taken up upon his death and he becomes a god. Hercules, by the way, not unlike Gilgamesh. And some people actually say that maybe Hercules is entirely based on Gilgamesh, or, you know, has some direct line where he joins the pantheon of gods. And in the case of Gilgamesh, Ninsun, Shamash, and several others, Ea, who we'll find later on in the story, he is the god of the Abzu, the waters beneath. So is that what Gilgamesh's destiny is ultimately in the story? And if so, what does that tell us about this story overall? Is this something that we just get a small glimpse of, and we're only to think of him ruling as a king at the end of the story, having become wiser and not knowing that death comes for us all? Anyway, I just was really struck by that. I did not even realize that Ninsun would speak with this kind of foreknowledge, that she actually knows what's going to happen to her son.
Yeah, I actually had an asterisk by that and was going to come around to it at some point in our conversation, because it is very striking, and it's kind of, I don't want to say out of nowhere, but it's like very much, it kind of breaks what's happening, right? I mean, she's being very straightforward in her petition for his safety, and then all of a sudden she's making this request that he be elevated next to Shamash. And like you said, that seems like an odd request, or at least one that's notable. And she even goes on from there. And I think this is, you know, literarily it's like foreshadowing, but it's brings up a lot of other questions as well. Because she is asking for something that is beyond what Gilgamesh may or may not receive. I mean, the story is yet to go that way, but we'll find out when we get there. But she goes on to even say, will he not grow wise with Ea of the ocean below? And we've already been told in the prologue that he does go to kind of the underworld and gets wisdom. And so she's kind of foreshadowing that and also requesting it at the same time. And so now we have a new question of, is he going to get this or not? And it also talks about, you know, dwelling in the land of no return and, you know, all of these things that you said. So she really is going from the heavens all the way down to the netherworld and saying that he's going to kind of be over all of this stuff in ways that other gods just aren't. And so it's an interesting move on her part to ask for this, because this is the elevation of a deity that we don't really see very often in the history of religion in this period. We do see it much later with Marduk, as he's eventually kind of put to the top deity of Babylon. There's a whole historical process that happens there, but we haven't seen it here, and we haven't seen it in a whole lot of other places. So it really is like not a unique request, but it's a very rare idea that he would kind of amass all of these responsibilities into one figure.
Absolutely. And I mean, I literally just recently, I did a series on Christmas with Caesar. You know, this is a speaking series where they ask the question, you know, who is the Son of God in the Christmas story and from Luke's perspective? And the whole idea of the Son of God in Roman culture was Julius Caesar, because he was divinized upon his death. You know, a comet appeared and Venus and Jupiter say, ah, you can join us. You're right there among us, Julius. In fact, we'll name a month after you. And then so when Augustus calls himself a son of a god, because he's the adopted son of Julius Caesar, he literally is from that point of view. And so when you see something like this, it's really interesting to think of this as not only how mortals or semi-mortals can become fully divinized. And again, lots of overlap with Hercules because of his combined parentage as being a demigod and going up to Mount Olympus. But also seeing in more recent times, at least from, you know, between now and then, how in the Roman period this was used both from a theological perspective, but also from an imperial perspective of, you need to say, you have to worship Caesar because he is a god and he's joined them. And therefore, it's part of the whole propaganda of how you permeate the imperial cult. So anyway, that's very striking, to say the least.
Yeah, and I'd be curious to know how often this kind of request is put forth in the literature, or if this is something peculiar to this iteration of Gilgamesh, kind of as you mentioned.
Yeah, and the last thing I'd say about this before we close is, to me, there's another parallel in this part of the story, and that is Ninsun is going to make request of Shamash. And so in some sense, there is, you don't have the god doing the action. Like, you have the human, or she's also a god, but you have the human representative going to the god and saying, this is what we need. And he then is going to color the rest of the story and favor Gilgamesh on his quest. And so I just wanted to bring up, when we get to the epic, within the epic, when we get to the flood story, we're going to find that Ea, or Enki, is actually going to do something very unique. He is going to be the one to pursue a human. He's going to pursue the flood hero to try to protect him. But it's interesting if we compare kind of the standoffishness of a sky god who has to be approached with a much more personal Ea, who is all around you in the flood below that you have to interact with. And he's kind of this trickster, but also is on your side most of the time. Loki kind of character, but more good than Loki. So it's interesting when we think about these two in parallel with one another, Shamash and Ea, the one who is head, who is god of the sky, and one who is god of the sea below.
Yeah, and I to kind of, as we were wrapping up this episode, to kind of get closer to the end of the tablet, and I appreciate Enkidu here, because all of the responsibility has been put on him by the elders and the young men of the town to basically stand in front of Gilgamesh and to, you know, it's just a way of saying, like, to be willing to sacrifice your life for this guy. And he's also kind of adopted by Ninsun as a son figure in order to give him more protection. And so really Enkidu in this role, according to everyone else, is just about telling Gilgamesh, you know, leading Gilgamesh there and also protecting Gilgamesh. And so there really isn't much of a care for Enkidu at this point in the narrative in terms of what he actually contributes here. But by the time we get to what for us is the last page of this tablet, so like around line 230, Enkidu still says to Gilgamesh, my friend, turn back. Do not pursue this journey. He says, like, you know, yes, I know the way. I know Humbaba. I know his characteristics. But let's just go home. Like, it's still
not worth it.
Yeah. And even after the support of the sun god and the support of Ninsun and all these, this cast of characters so far, he's just saying it's not worth it.
Right. And we'll see next time how Enkidu, despite knowing this, he's going to fully serve Gilgamesh. One last thing for me, just a final observation, is that to go back to your point about science and the way the world works, let's just say an explanation of Shamash doing what Shamash is going to do, is we read here in Ninsun's prayer to make the days longer. And so one of the ways in which they're going to travel in the journey to the Forest of Cedar is they're going to travel long distances, much further than any other man or mortal could. And they're actually aided in that, not only by their extremely long stride, which we've talked about in the past, but by the heavens itself. And here, I think that there's a final biblical inference. It's not a direct connection, but I am struck by the connection in the book of Joshua, where we have Joshua requesting more time to defeat his enemies. And he says, Yahweh, make the moon stand still over Gibeon and the sun stand still over Ayalon. Maybe I mixed those up. I can't remember which. But it's the same idea that the days will be lengthened so that I can carry out my heroic act. And so we see a similar element to this. And why would this be okay? Because Shamash has the ability to make the sun stay in the sky a little longer because he is, after all, the sun itself. And once again, he couldn't have the power over the moon to do that. But in Joshua chapter 10, it is Yahweh who has the ability over the sun and the moon, which in ancient Mesopotamian belief are two different deities, two different divinities who act maybe in league or independent with one another. So we can see another similarity there as well. Well, guys, we've enjoyed making it through tablet 3. Next time we'll encounter tablet 4, the journey to the Forest of Cedar, which is a really incredible part of this journey. I imagine, well, we won't quite get through all of it in one episode. I know Amy is excited about sharing a bunch of details from this tablet, but we'll continue to make our way through this amazing, dare I say, epic. Well, that's what it's called, the Epic of Gilgamesh, and try to see its connection in the wider biblical world. But until then, keep digging.
You've been listening to OnScript's Biblical World podcast. If you enjoy the show, please show your support by giving us a rating on iTunes or wherever you listen. You can support the show by visiting onscript.study/donate. Until next time, keep digging.